therefore became the primary target. For similar reasons, California also became a target for KSM. KSM claims that the earlier bombing of the World Trade Center taught him that bombs and explosives could be problematic, and that he needed to graduate to a more novel form of attack. He maintains that he and Youssef began thinking about using aircraft as weapons while working on the Manila Air Boyinka plot, and speculated about striking the World Trade Center and CIA headquarters as early as 1995. Certainly, KSM was not alone in contemplating new kinds of terrorist operations. A study reportedly conducted by ATAF while he and bin Laden were still in Sudan concluded that traditional terrorist hijacking operations did not fit the needs of al-Qaeda because such hijackings were used to negotiate the release of prisoners rather than to inflict mass casualties. The study is said to have considered the feasibility of hijacking planes and blowing them up in flight, paralleling the Boyinka concept. Such a study, if it actually existed, yields significant insight into the thinking of al-Qaeda's leaders. 1. They rejected hijackings aimed at gaining the release of imprisoned comrades as too complex because al-Qaeda had no friendly countries in which to land a plane and then negotiate. 2. They considered the bombing of commercial flights in mid-air as carried out against Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie, Scotland, a promising means to inflict massive casualties. And 3. They did not yet consider using hijacked aircraft as weapons against other targets. KSM has insisted to his interrogators that he always contemplated hijacking and crashing large commercial aircraft. Indeed, KSM describes a grandiose original plan, a total of 10 aircraft to be hijacked, 9 of which would crash into targets on both coasts. They included those eventually hit on September 11th, plus CIA and FBI headquarters, nuclear power plants, and the tallest buildings in California and the state of Washington. KSM himself was to land the 10th plane at a U.S. airport after killing all adult male passengers on board and alerting the media, deliver a speech excoriating U.S. support for Israel, the Philippines, and repressive governments in the Arab world. Beyond KSM's rationalizations about targeting the U.S. economy, this vision gives a better glimpse of his true ambitions. This is theater, a spectacle of destruction with KSM as the self-cast star, the super-terrorist. KSM concedes that this proposal received a lukewarm response from al-Qaeda leaders, skeptical of its scale and complexity. Although bin Laden listened to KSM's proposal, he was not convinced that it was practical. As mentioned earlier, bin Laden was receiving numerous ideas for potential operations. KSM's proposal to attack U.S. targets with commercial airplanes was only one of many. KSM presents himself as an entrepreneur seeking venture capital and people. He simply wanted al-Qaeda to supply the money and operatives needed for the attack, while retaining his independence. It is easy to question such a statement. Money is one thing, supplying a cadre of trained operatives willing to die is much more. Thus, although KSM contends he would have been just as likely to consider working with any comparable terrorist organization, he gives no indication of what other groups he thought could supply such exceptional commodities. KSM acknowledges formally joining al-Qaeda in late 1998 or 99, and states that soon afterward, bin Laden also made the decision to support his proposal to attack the United States using commercial airplanes as weapons. Though KSM speculates about how bin Laden came to share his preoccupation with attacking America, bin Laden in fact had long been an opponent of the United States. KSM thinks that ATAF may have persuaded bin Laden to approve this specific proposal. ATAF's role in the entire operation is unquestionably very significant, but tends to fade into the background, in part because ATAF himself is not available to describe it. He was killed in November 2001 by an American airstrike in Afghanistan. Bin Laden summoned KSM to Kandahar in March or April 1999 to tell him that al-Qaeda would support his proposal. The plot was now referred to within al-Qaeda as the Plains Operation. The plan evolves. Bin Laden reportedly discussed the planes operation with KSM and ATAF in a series of meetings in the spring of 1999 at the Al-Matar complex near Kandahar. KSM's original concept of using one of the hijacked planes to make a media statement was scrapped, but bin Laden considered the basic idea feasible. Bin Laden, ATAF, and KSM developed an initial list of targets. These included the White House, the U.S. Capitol, the Pentagon, and the World Trade Center. According to KSM, bin Laden wanted to destroy the White House and the Pentagon. KSM wanted to strike the World Trade Center, and all of them wanted to hit the Capitol. No one else was involved in the initial selection of targets. Bin Laden also soon selected 4 individuals to serve as suicide operatives: Khalid al-Mihdhar, Nawaf al-Hazmi, Khalad, and Abu Barah al-Yemeni. During the al-Matar meetings, bin Laden told KSM that Middar and Hazmi were so eager to participate in an operation against the United States that they had already obtained U.S. visas. KSM states that they'd done so on their own after the suicide of their friend Azam, Nashiri's cousin, in carrying out the Nairobi bombing. KSM had not met them. His only guidance from bin Laden was that the two should eventually go to the United States for pilot training. Hazmi and Middar were Saudi nationals born in Mecca. Like the others in this initial group of selectees, they were already experienced mujahideen. They'd traveled together to fight in Bosnia in a group that journeyed to the Balkans in 1995. By the time Hazmi and Middar were assigned to the Plains operation in early 1999, they had visited Afghanistan on several occasions. Khalad was another veteran mujahid, like much of his family. His father had been expelled from Yemen because of his extremist views. Khalad had grown up in Saudi Arabia, where his father knew bin Laden, Abdullah Azam, and Omar Abdelrahman, the blind sheikh. Khalad departed for Afghanistan in 1994 at the age of 15. 3 years later, he lost his lower right leg in a battle with the Northern Alliance, a battle in which one of his brothers died. After this experience, he pledged allegiance to bin Laden, whom he'd first met as a child in Jeddah, and volunteered to become a suicide operative. When Khalad applied for a U.S. visa, however, his application was denied. Earlier in 1999, bin Laden had sent Khalad to Yemen to help Nashiri obtain explosives for the planned ship bombing and to obtain a visa to visit the United States so that he could participate in an operation there. Khalad applied under another name, using the cover story that he would be visiting a medical clinic to obtain a new prosthesis for his leg. Another al-Qaeda operative gave Khalad the name of a person living in the United States whom Khalad could use as a point of contact on a visa application. Khalad contacted this individual to help him get an appointment at a U.S. clinic. While Khalad was waiting for the letter from the clinic confirming the appointment, however, he was arrested by Yemeni authorities. The arrest resulted from mistaken identity. Khalad was driving the car of another conspirator in the ship-bombing plot who was wanted by the Yemeni authorities. Khalad was released sometime during the summer of 1999 after his father and bin Laden intervened on his behalf. Khalad learned later that the al-Qaeda leader, apparently concerned that Khalad might reveal Nashiri's operation while under interrogation, had contacted a Yemeni official to demand Khalad's release, suggesting that bin Laden would not confront the Yemenis if they did not confront him. This account has been corroborated by others. Giving up on acquiring a U.S. visa and concerned that the United States might learn of his ties to al-Qaeda, Khalad returned to Afghanistan. Travel issues thus played a part in al-Qaeda's operational planning from the very start. During the spring and summer of 1999, KSM realized that Khalad and Abu Barah, both of whom were Yemeni, would not be able to obtain U.S. visas as easily as Saudi operatives like Middar and Hazmi. Although Khalad had been unable to acquire a U.S. visa, KSM still wanted him and Abu Barah, as well as another Yemeni operative from bin Laden's security detail, to participate in the planes operation. Yet, because individuals with Saudi passports could travel much more easily than Yemeni, particularly to the United States, there were fewer martyrdom opportunities for Yemenis. To overcome this problem, KSM decided to split the planes operation into two components. The first part of the planes operation, crashing hijacked aircraft into U.S. targets, would remain as planned, with Middar and Hazmi playing key roles. The second part, however, would now embrace the idea of using suicide operatives to blow up planes, a refinement of KSM's old Manila air plot. The operatives would hijack U.S.-flagged commercial planes flying Pacific routes across East Asia and destroy them in midair, possibly with shoe bombs instead of flying them into targets. An alternate scenario apparently involved flying planes into U.S. targets in Japan, Singapore, and Korea. This part of the operation has been confirmed by Khalad, who said they contemplated hijacking several planes, probably originating in Thailand, South Korea, Hong Kong, or Malaysia, and using Yemenis who would not need pilot training because they would simply down the planes. All the planes hijacked in the United States and East Asia were to be crashed or exploded at about the same time to maximize the attack's psychological impact. Training and deployment to Kuala Lumpur. In the fall of 1999, four operatives selected by bin Laden for the planes operation were chosen to attend an elite training course at al-Qaeda's Mess Ainak camp in Afghanistan. Bin Laden personally selected the veteran fighters who received this training, and several of them were destined for important operations. One example is Ibrahim al-Thawar, or Nibras, who would participate in the October 12, 2000 suicide attack on the USS Cole. According to KSM, this training was not given specifically in preparation for the plane's operation or any other particular Al-Qaeda venture. Although KSM claims not to have been involved with the training or to have met with the future 9/11 hijackers at Mesanak, he says he did visit the camp while traveling from Kandahar to Kabul with bin Laden and others. The Mesanak training camp was located in an abandoned Russian copper mine near Kabul. The camp opened in 1999, after the United States had destroyed the training camp near Khost with cruise missiles in August 1998, and before the Taliban granted Al-Qaeda permission to open the Al-Farouq camp in Kandahar. Thus, for a brief period in 1999, Mesanak was the only Al-Qaeda camp operating in Afghanistan. It offered a full range of instruction, including an advanced commando course taught by senior Al-Qaeda member Saif al-Adl. Bin Laden paid particular attention to the 1999 training session. When Salah al-Din, the trainer for the session, complained about the number of trainees and said that no more than 20 could be handled at once, bin Laden insisted that everyone he selected receive the training. The special training session at Mesanak was rigorous and spared no expense. The course focused on physical fitness, firearms, close-quarters combat, shooting from a motorcycle, and night operations. Although the subjects taught differed little from those offered at other camps, the course placed extraordinary physical and mental demands on its participants, who received the best food and other amenities to enhance their strength and morale. Upon completing the advanced training at Mesanak, Hazmi, Khalad, and Abu Bara went to Karachi, Pakistan. There, KSM instructed them on Western culture and travel. Much of his activity in mid-1999 had revolved around the collection of training and informational materials for the participants in the plane's operation. For instance, he collected Western aviation magazines, telephone directories for American cities such as San Diego and Long Beach, California, brochures for schools, and airline timetables, and he conducted internet searches on U.S. flight schools. He also purchased flight simulator software and a few movies depicting hijackings. To house his students, KSM rented a safe house in Karachi with money provided by bin Laden. In early December 1999, Khalad and Abu Bara arrived in Karachi. Hazmi joined them a few days later there. On his way to Karachi, Hazmi spent a night in Quetta at a safe house where, according to KSM, an Egyptian named Mohammed Atta simultaneously stayed on his way to Afghanistan for jihad training. Midar did not attend the training in Karachi with the others. KSM says that he never met with Midar in 1999, but assumed that bin Laden and Atif had briefed Midar on the plane's operation and had excused him from the Karachi training. The course in Karachi apparently lasted about 1 or 2 weeks. According to KSM, he taught the three operatives basic English words and phrases. He showed them how to read phone books, interpret airline timetables, use the internet, use code words and communications, make travel reservations, and rent an apartment. Khalad adds that the training involved using flight simulator computer games, viewing movies that featured hijackings, and reading flight schedules to determine which flights would be in the air at the same time in different parts of the world. They used the game software to increase their familiarity with aircraft models and functions, and to highlight gaps in cabin security. While in Karachi, they also discussed how to case flights in Southeast Asia. KSM told them to watch the cabin doors at takeoff and landing to observe whether the captain went to the lavatory during the flight, and to note whether the flight attendants brought food into the cockpit. KSM, Khalad, and Hazmi also visited travel agencies to learn the visa requirements for Asian countries. The four trainees traveled to Kuala Lumpur. Khalad, Abu Bara, and Hazmi came from Karachi. Midar traveled from Yemen. As is discussed in Chapter 6, U.S. intelligence would analyze communications associated with Midar, whom they identified during this travel, and Hazmi, whom they could have identified but did not. According to KSM, the four operatives were aware that they had volunteered for a suicide operation, either in the United States or in Asia. With different roles, they had different tasks. Hazmi and Midar were sent to Kuala Lumpur before proceeding to their final destination, the United States. According to KSM, they were to use Yemeni documents to fly to Malaysia, then proceed to the United States using their Saudi passports to conceal their prior travels to and from Pakistan. KSM had doctored Hazmi's Saudi passport, so it would appear as if Hazmi had traveled to Kuala Lumpur from Saudi Arabia via Dubai. Khalad and Abu Bara went to Kuala Lumpur to study airport security and conduct casing flights. According to Khalad, he and Abu Bara departed for Malaysia in mid-December 1999. Hazmi joined them about 10 days later, after briefly returning to Afghanistan, to attend to some passport issues. Khalid had originally scheduled his trip in order to receive a new prosthesis at a Kuala Lumpur clinic called Endolite, and bin Laden suggested that he use the opportunity to case flights as well. According to Khalid, Malaysia was an ideal destination because its government did not require citizens of Saudi Arabia or other Gulf states to have a visa. Malaysian security was reputed to be lax when it came to Islamist jihadists. Also, other mujahideen wounded in combat had reportedly received treatment at the Endolite clinic and successfully concealed the origins of their injuries. Khalid said he got the money for the prosthesis from his father, bin Laden, and another al-Qaeda colleague. According to Khalid, when he and Abu Bara arrived in Kuala Lumpur, they contacted Hambali to let him know where they were staying, since he was to be kept informed of al-Qaeda activities in Southeast Asia. Hambali picked up Khalid and Abu Bara and brought them to his home, enlisting the help of a colleague who spoke better Arabic. Hambali then took them to the clinic. On December 31st, Khalid flew from Kuala Lumpur to Bangkok. The next day, he flew to Hong Kong aboard a U.S. airliner. He flew in first class, which he realized was a mistake because this seating assignment on the flight did not afford him a view of the cockpit. He claims to have done what he could to case the flight, testing security by carrying a box cutter in his toiletries kit onto the flight to Hong Kong. Khalid returned to Bangkok the following day. At the airport, the security official searched his carry-on bag and even opened the toiletries kit, but just glanced at the contents and let him pass. On this flight, Khalid waited until most of the first-class passengers were dozing, then got up and removed the kit from his carry-on. None of the flight attendants took notice. After completing his casing mission, Khalid returned to Kuala Lumpur. Hazmi arrived in Kuala Lumpur soon thereafter, and may even have stayed briefly with Khalid and Abu Bara at Endolite. Midar arrived on January 25th, probably one day after Hazmi. All four operatives stayed at the apartment of Yazid Sulfat, the Malaysian JI member who made his home available at Hambali's request. According to Khalid, he and Hazmi spoke about the possibility of hijacking planes and crashing them or holding passengers as hostages, but only speculatively. Khalid admits being aware at the time that Hazmi and Midar were involved in an operation involving planes in the United States, but denies knowing details of the plan. While in Kuala Lumpur, Khalid wanted to go to Singapore to meet Nibras and Fahd Al-Kuso, two of the operatives in Nashiri's ship-bombing operation. An attempt to execute that plan by attacking the USS The Sullivans had failed just a few days earlier. Nibras and Kuso were bringing Khalid money from Yemen, but were stopped in Bangkok because they lacked visas to continue on to Singapore. Also unable to enter Singapore, Khalid moved the meeting to Bangkok. Hazmi and Midar decided to go there as well, reportedly because they thought it would enhance their cover as tourists to have passport stamps from a popular tourist destination such as Thailand. With Hambali's help, the three obtained tickets for a flight to Bangkok and left Kuala Lumpur together. Abu Bara did not have a visa permitting him to return to Pakistan, so he traveled to Yemen instead. In Bangkok, Khalid took Hazmi and Midar to one hotel, then went to another hotel for his meeting on the maritime attack plan. Hazmi and Midar soon moved to that same hotel, but Khalid insists that the two sets of operatives never met with each other, or anyone else. After conferring with the ship-bombing operatives, Khalid returned to Karachi and then to Kandahar, where he reported on his casing mission to bin Laden. Bin Laden canceled the East Asia part of the plane's operation in the spring of 2000. He evidently decided it would be too difficult to coordinate this attack with the operation in the United States. As for Hazmi and Midar, they had left Bangkok a few days before Khalid and arrived in Los Angeles on January 15, 2000. Meanwhile, the next troop of al-Qaeda operatives destined for the plane's operation had just surfaced in Afghanistan. As Hazmi and Midar were deploying from Asia to the United States, al-Qaeda's leadership was recruiting and training four Western-educated men who had recently arrived in Kandahar. Though they hailed from four different countries, Egypt, the United Arab Emirates, Lebanon, and Yemen, they had formed a close-knit group as students in Hamburg, Germany. The new recruits had come to Afghanistan, aspiring to wage jihad in Chechnya. But al-Qaeda quickly recognized their potential and enlisted them in its anti-U.S. jihad. Section 5.3. The Hamburg Contingent. Although bin Laden, Atef, and KSM initially contemplated using established al-Qaeda members to execute the plane's operation, the late 1999 arrival in Kandahar of four aspiring jihadists from Germany suddenly presented a more attractive alternative. The Hamburg group shared the anti-U.S. fervor of the other candidates for the operation, but added the enormous advantages of fluency in English and familiarity with life in the West based on years that each member of the group had spent living in Germany. Not surprisingly, Muhammad Atta, Ramzi bin al-Shib, Marwan al-Shihi, and Ziad Jarrah would all become key players in the 9/11 conspiracy. Muhammad Atta. Muhammad Atta was born on September 1, 1968, in Kafr el-Sheikh, Egypt, to a middle-class family headed by his father, an attorney. After graduating from Cairo University with a degree in architectural engineering in 1990, Atta worked as an urban planner in Cairo for a couple of years. In the fall of 1991, he asked a German family he'd met in Cairo to help him continue his education in Germany. They suggested he come to Hamburg and invited him to live with them there, at least initially. After completing a course in German, Atta traveled to Germany for the first time in July 1992. He resided briefly in Stuttgart and then, in the fall of 1992, moved to Hamburg to live with his host family. After enrolling at the University of Hamburg, he promptly transferred into the City Engineering and Planning course at the Technical University of Hamburg, Harburg, where he would remain registered as a student until the fall of 1999. He appears to have applied himself fairly seriously to his studies, at least in comparison to his jihadist friends, and actually received his degree shortly before traveling to Afghanistan. In school, Atta came across as very intelligent and reasonably pleasant, with an excellent command of the German language. When Atta arrived in Germany, he appeared religious, but not fanatically so. This would change, especially as his tendency to assert leadership became increasingly pronounced. According to bin al-Shib, as early as 1995, Atta sought to organize a Muslim student association in Hamburg. In the fall of 1997, he joined a working group of the Quds Mosque in Hamburg, a group designed to bridge the gap between Muslims and Christians. Atta proved a poor bridge, however, because of his abrasive and increasingly dogmatic personality. But among those who shared his beliefs, Atta stood out as a decision-maker. Atta's friends during this period remember him as charismatic, intelligent, and persuasive, albeit intolerant of dissent. In his interactions with other students, Atta voiced virulently anti-Semitic and anti-American opinions, ranging from condemnations of what he described as a global Jewish movement centered in New York City that supposedly controlled the financial world and the media to polemics against governments of the Arab world. To him, Saddam Hussein was an American stooge, set up to give Washington an excuse to intervene in the Middle East. Within his circle, Atta advocated violent jihad. He reportedly asked one individual close to the group if he was ready to fight for his belief, and dismissed him as too weak for jihad when the person declined. On a visit home to Egypt in 1998, Atta met one of his college friends. According to this friend, Atta had changed a great deal, had grown a beard, and had obviously adopted fundamentalism by that time. Ramzi bin al-Shib. Ramzi bin al-Shib was born on May 1, 1972, in Gail Bawazir, Yemen. There does not seem to be anything remarkable about his family or early background. A friend who knew bin al-Shib in Yemen remembers him as religious, but not too religious. From 1987 to 1995, bin al-Shib worked as a clerk for the International Bank of Yemen. He first attempted to leave Yemen in 1995, when he applied for a U.S. visa. After his application was rejected, he went to Germany and applied for asylum under the name Ramzi Omar, claiming to be a Sudanese citizen seeking asylum. While his asylum petition was pending, bin al-Shib lived in Hamburg and associated with individuals from several mosques there. In 1997, after his asylum application was denied, bin al-Shib went home to Yemen but returned to Germany shortly thereafter under his true name, this time registering as a student in Hamburg. Bin al-Shib continually had academic problems, failing tests and cutting classes. He was expelled from one school in September of 1998. According to bin al-Shib, he and Atta first met at a mosque in Hamburg in 1995. The two men became close friends and became identified with their shared extremist outlook. Like Atta, by the late 1990s, bin al-Shib was decrying what he perceived to be a Jewish world conspiracy. He proclaimed that the highest duty of every Muslim was to pursue jihad, and that the highest honor was to die during the jihad. Despite his rhetoric, however, bin al-Shib presented a more amiable figure than the austere Atta, who was known within the community as being sociable, extroverted, polite, and adventuresome. In 1998, bin al-Shib and Atta began sharing an apartment in the Harburg section of Hamburg, together with a young student from the United Arab Emirates named Marwan al-Shihi. Marwan al-Shihi. Marwan al-Shihi was born on May 9, 1978, in Ras al-Khaimah in the United Arab Emirates. His father, who died in 1997, was a prayer leader at the local mosque. After graduating from high school in 1995, Shihi joined the Emirati military and received half a year of basic training before gaining admission to a military scholarship program that would fund his continued study in Germany. Shihi first entered Germany in April 1996. After sharing an apartment in Bonn for 2 months with three other scholarship students, Shihi moved in with a German family, with whom he resided for several months before moving into his own apartment. During this period, he came across as very religious, praying 5 times a day. Friends also remember him as convivial and a regular guy, wearing Western clothes and occasionally renting cars for trips to Berlin, France, and the Netherlands. As a student, Shihi was less than a success. Upon completing a course in German, he enrolled at the University of Bonn in a program for technical, mathematical, and scientific studies. In June 1997, he requested a leave from his studies, citing the need to attend to unspecified problems in his home country. Although the university denied his request, Shihi left anyway, and consequently was compelled to repeat the first semester of his studies. In addition to having academic difficulties at this time, Shihi appeared to become more extreme in the practice of his faith. For example, he specifically avoided restaurants that cooked with or served alcohol. In late 1997, he applied for permission to complete his coursework in Hamburg, a request apparently motivated by his desire to join Atta and Bin al-Shib. Just how and when the three of them first met remains unclear, although they seemed to know each other already when Shihi relocated to Hamburg in early 1998. Atta and Bin al-Shib moved into his apartment in April. The transfer to Hamburg did not help Shihi's academic progress. He was directed by the scholarship program administrators at the Emirati Embassy to repeat his second semester starting in August 1998, but back in Bonn. Shihi initially flouted this directive, however, and did not re-enroll at the University of Bonn until the following January, barely passing his course there. By the end of July 1999, he'd returned to Hamburg, applying to study shipbuilding at the Technical University, and more significantly, residing once again with Atta and Bin al-Shib, in an apartment at 54 Marienstrasse. After Shihi moved in with Atta and Bin al-Shib, his evolution toward Islamic fundamentalism became more pronounced. A fellow Emiriati student who came to Hamburg to visit Shihi noticed he no longer lived as comfortably as before. Shihi now occupied an old apartment with a roommate, had no television, and wore inexpensive clothes. When asked why he was living so frugally, Shihi responded that he was living the way the Prophet had lived. Similarly, when someone asked why he and Atta never laughed, Shihi retorted, "How can you laugh when people are dying in Palestine?" Zia Jarrah. Born on May 11, 1975, in Mazra, Lebanon, Zia Jarrah came from an affluent family and attended private Christian schools. Like Atta, Bin al-Shib, and Shihi, Jarrah aspired to pursue higher education in Germany. In April 1996, he and a cousin enrolled at a junior college in Greifswald in northeastern Germany. There, Jarrah met and became intimate with Aysel Sengwin, the daughter of Turkish immigrants who was preparing to study dentistry. Even with the benefit of hindsight, Jarrah hardly seems a likely candidate for becoming an Islamic extremist. Far from displaying radical beliefs when he first moved to Germany, he arrived with a reputation for knowing where to find the best discos and beaches in Beirut, and in Greifswald was known to enjoy student parties and drinking beer. Although he continued to share an apartment in Greifswald with his cousin, Jarrah was mostly at Sengwin's apartment. Witnesses interviewed by German authorities after 9/11, however, recall that Jarrah started showing signs of radicalization as early as the end of 1996. After returning from a trip home to Lebanon, Jarrah started living more strictly according to the Quran. He read brochures in Arabic about jihad, held forth to friends on the subject of holy war, and professed disaffection with his previous life and a desire not to leave the world in a natural way. In September 1997, Jarrah abruptly switched his intended course of study from dentistry to aircraft engineering at the Technical University of Hamburg-Harburg. His motivation for this decision remains unclear. The rationale he expressed to Sengwin, that he'd been interested in aviation since playing with toy airplanes as a child, rings somewhat hollow. In any event, Jarrah appears already to have had Hamburg contacts by this time, some of whom may have played a role in steering him toward Islamic extremism. Following his move to Hamburg that fall, he began visiting Sanguin and Greifswald on weekends, until she moved to the German city of Bochum 1 year later to enroll in dental school. Around the same time, he began speaking increasingly about religion, and his visits to Sanguin became less and less frequent. He began criticizing her for not being religious enough and for dressing too provocatively. He grew a full beard and started praying regularly. He refused to introduce her to his Hamburg friends because, he told her, they were religious Muslims, and her refusal to become more observant embarrassed him. At some point in 1999, Jarrah told Sanguin that he was planning to wage a jihad because there was no greater honor than to die for Allah. Although Jarrah's transformation generated numerous quarrels, their breakups invariably were followed by reconciliation. Forming a cell. In Hamburg, Jarrah had a succession of living accommodations, but he apparently never resided with his future co-conspirators. It is not clear how and when he became part of Atta's circle. He became particularly friendly with Bin al-Shib after meeting him at the Quds Mosque in Hamburg, which Jarrah began attending regularly in late 1997. The worshippers at this mosque featured an outspoken, flamboyant Islamist named Mohammed Haider Zamar. A well-known figure in the Muslim community and to German and U.S. intelligence agencies by the late 1990s, Zamar had fought in Afghanistan and relished any opportunity to extol the virtues of violent jihad. Indeed, a witness has reported hearing Zamar press Bin al-Shib to fulfill his duty to wage jihad. Moreover, after 9/11, Zamar reportedly took credit for influencing not just Bin al-Shib but the rest of the Hamburg group. In 1998, Zamar encouraged them to participate in jihad and even convinced them to go to Afghanistan. Owing to Zamar's persuasion or some other source of inspiration, Atta, Bin al-Shib, Sheehy, and Jarrah eventually prepared themselves to translate their extremist beliefs into action. By late 1999, they were ready to abandon their student lives in Germany in favor of violent jihad. This final stage in their evolution toward embracing Islamist extremism did not entirely escape the notice of the people around them. The foursome became core members of a group of radical Muslims, often hosting sessions at their Marienstrasse apartment that involved extremely anti-American discussions. Meeting 3 to 4 times a week, the group became something of a sect whose members, according to one participant in the meetings, tended to deal only with each other. Atta's rent checks for the apartment provide evidence of the importance that the apartment assumed as a center for the group, as he would write on them the notation Dar al-Ansar, or House of the Followers. In addition to Atta, Bin al-Shib, Sheehy, and Jarrah, the group included other extremists, some of whom also would attend al-Qaeda training camps, and in some instances would help the 9/11 hijackers as they executed the plot. Saeed Bahaji, son of a Moroccan immigrant, was the only German citizen in the group. Educated in Morocco, Bahaji returned to Germany to study electrical engineering at the Technical University of Hamburg-Harburg. He spent 5 months in the German army before obtaining a medical discharge and lived with Atta and Bin al-Shib at 54 Marienstrasse for 8 months between November 1998 and July 1999. Described as an insecure follower with no personality and with limited knowledge of Islam, Bahaji nonetheless professed his readiness to engage in violence. Atta and Bin al-Shib used Bahaji's computer for internet research, as evidenced by documents and diskettes seized by German authorities after 9/11. Zakaria Essebar, a Moroccan citizen, moved to Germany in February 1997 and to Hamburg in 1998, where he studied medical technology. Soon after moving to Hamburg, Essebar met Bin al-Shib and the others through a Turkish mosque. Essebar turned extremist fairly suddenly, probably in 1999, and reportedly pressured one acquaintance with physical force to become more religious, grow a beard, and compel his wife to convert to Islam. Essebar's parents were said to have made repeated but unsuccessful efforts to sway him away from the lifestyle. Shortly before the 9/11 attacks, he would travel to Afghanistan to communicate the date for the attacks to the al-Qaeda leadership. Monir el-Motasadiq, another Moroccan, came to Germany in 1993, moving to Hamburg 2 years later to study electrical engineering at the Technical University. A witness has recalled Motasadiq saying that he would kill his entire family if his religious beliefs demanded it. One of Mosta Sadiq's roommates recalls him referring to Hitler as a good man and organizing film sessions that included speeches by Bin Laden. Mosta Sadiq would help conceal the Hamburg group's trip to Afghanistan in late 1999. Abdelghani Mouzouri, also a Moroccan, arrived in Germany in the summer of 1993 after completing university courses in physics and chemistry. Mouzouri studied in Dortmund, Bochum, and Munster before moving to Hamburg in 1995. Mouzouri described himself as a weak Muslim when he was home in Morocco, but much more devout when he was back in Hamburg. In April 1996, Mouzouri and Mota Sadiq witnessed the execution of Atta's will. During the course of 1999, Atta and his group became ever more extreme and secretive, speaking only in Arabic to conceal the content of their conversations. When the four core members of the Hamburg cell left Germany to journey to Afghanistan late that year, it seems unlikely that they already knew about the planes operation. No evidence connects them to Al-Qaeda before that time. Witnesses have attested, however, that their pronouncements reflected ample predisposition toward taking some action against the United States. In short, they fit the bill for bin Laden, ATEF, and KSM. Going to Afghanistan. The available evidence indicates that in 1999, Atta bin al-Shib, Shihi, and Jarrah decided to fight in Chechnya against the Russians. According to bin al-Shib, a chance meeting on a train in Germany caused the group to travel to Afghanistan instead. An individual named Khalid al-Masri approached bin al-Shib and Shihi because they were Arabs with beards, bin al-Shib thinks, and struck up a conversation about jihad in Chechnya. When they later called Masri and expressed interest in going to Chechnya, he told them to contact Abu Musab in Duisburg, Germany. Abu Musab turned out to be Mohammadu Ould Slahi, a significant Al-Qaeda operative who even then was well known to U.S. and German intelligence, though neither government apparently knew he was operating in Germany in late 1999. When telephoned by bin al-Shib and Shihi, Slahi reportedly invited these promising recruits to come see him in Duisburg. Bin al-Shib, Shihi, and Jarrah made the trip. When they arrived, Slahi explained that it was difficult to get to Chechnya at the time because many travelers were being detained in Georgia. He recommended they go to Afghanistan instead, where they could train for jihad before traveling onward to Chechnya. Slahi instructed them to obtain Pakistani visas and then return to him for further directions on how to reach Afghanistan. Although Atta did not attend the meeting, he joined in the plan with the other three. After obtaining the necessary visas, they received Slahi's final instructions on how to travel to Karachi and then to Quetta, where they were to contact someone named Umar al-Masri at the Taliban office. Following Slahi's advice, Atta and Jarrah left Hamburg during the last week of November 1999, bound for Karachi. Shihi left for Afghanistan around the same time, bin al-Shib about 2 weeks later. Bin al-Shib remembers that when he arrived at the Taliban office in Quetta, there was no one named Umar al-Masri. The name apparently was simply a code. A group of Afghans from the office promptly escorted him to Kandahar. There, bin al-Shib rejoined Atta and Jarrah, who said they had already pledged loyalty to bin Laden and urged him to do the same. They also informed him that Shihi had pledged as well and had already left for the United Arab Emirates to prepare for the mission. Bin al-Shib soon met privately with bin Laden, accepted the al-Qaeda leader's invitation to work under him, and added his own pledge to those of his Hamburg colleagues. By this time, bin al-Shib claims he assumed he was volunteering for a martyrdom operation. Atta, Jarrah, and bin al-Shib then met with Atif, who told them they were about to undertake a highly secret mission. As bin al-Shib tells it, Atif instructed the three to return to Germany and enroll in flight training. Atta, whom bin Laden chose to lead the group, met with bin Laden several times to receive additional instructions, including a preliminary list of approved targets: the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, and the U.S. Capitol. The new recruits also learned that an individual named Rabia al-Maki, Nawaf al-Hazmi, would be part of the operation. In retrospect, the speed with which Atta, Shihi, Jarrah, and bin al-Shib became core members of the 9/11 plot, with Atta designated its operational leader, is remarkable. They had not yet met with KSM when all this occurred. It is clear then that bin Laden and Atta were very much in charge of the operation. That these candidates were selected so quickly, before comprehensive testing in the training camps or in operations, demonstrates that bin Laden and Atef probably already understood the deficiencies of their initial team, Hazmi and Midar. The new recruits from Germany possessed an ideal combination of technical skill and knowledge that the original 9/11 operatives, veteran fighters though they were, lacked. Bin Laden and Atef wasted no time in assigning the Hamburg group to the most ambitious operation yet planned by Al-Qaeda. Bin Laden and Atif also plainly judged that Atta was best suited to be the tactical commander of the operation. Such a quick and critical judgment invites speculation about whether they'd already taken out his measure at some earlier meeting. To be sure, some gaps do appear in the record about his known whereabouts during the preceding years. One such gap is February to March 1998, a period for which there's no evidence of his presence in Germany, and when he conceivably could have been in Afghanistan. Yet, to date, neither KSM bin al-Shib nor any other al-Qaeda figure interrogated about the 9/11 plot has claimed that Atta or any other member of the Hamburg group traveled to Afghanistan before the trip in late 1999. While the four core Hamburg cell members were in Afghanistan, their associates back in Hamburg handled their affairs so that the trip could be kept secret. Mota Sadiq appears to have done the most. He terminated Sheehy's apartment lease, telling the landlord that Sheehy had returned to the UAE for family reasons and used a power of attorney to pay bills from Sheehy's bank account. Mota Sadiq also assisted Jarrah, offering to look after ISIL Sangwen in Jarrah's absence. Saeed Bahaji attended to similar routine matters for Atta and bin al-Shib, thereby helping them remain abroad without drawing attention to their absence. Preparing for the operation. In early 2000, Atta, Jarrah, and bin al-Shib returned to Hamburg. Jarrah arrived first on January 31, 2000. According to bin al-Shib, he and Atta left Kandahar together and proceeded first to Karachi, where they met KSM and were instructed by him on security and on living in the United States. Sheehy apparently had already met with KSM before returning to the UAE. Atta returned to Hamburg in late February, and bin al-Shib arrived shortly thereafter. Sheehy's travels took him to the UAE, where he acquired a new passport and a U.S. visa, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and one or more other destinations. Sheehy also returned to Germany, possibly sometime in March. After leaving Afghanistan, the hijackers made clear efforts to avoid appearing radical. Once back in Hamburg, they distanced themselves from conspicuous extremists like Zamar, whom they knew attracted unwanted attention from the authorities. They also changed their appearance and behavior. Atta wore Western clothing, shaved his beard, and no longer attended extremist mosques. Jarrah also no longer wore a full beard, and according to Sangwen, acted much more the way he had when she first met him. And when Sheehy, while still in the UAE in January 2000, held a belated wedding celebration. He actually had been married in 1999. A friend of his was surprised to see that he'd shaved off his beard and was acting like his old self again. But Jarrah's apparent efforts to appear less radical did not completely conceal his transformation from his Lebanese family, which grew increasingly concerned about his fanaticism. Soon after Jarrah returned to Germany, his father asked Jarrah's cousin, a close companion from boyhood, to intercede. The cousin's ensuing effort to persuade Jarrah to depart from the path he was taking proved unavailing. Yet Jarrah clearly differed from the other hijackers in that he maintained much closer contact with his family and continued his intimate relationship with Sangwen. These ties may well have caused him to harbor some doubts about going through with the plot, even as late as the summer of 2001, as is discussed in Chapter 7. After leaving Afghanistan, the four began researching flight schools and aviation training. In early January 2000, Ali Abdulaziz Ali, a nephew of KSM living in the UAE, who had become an important facilitator in the plot, used Sheehy's credit card to order a Boeing 747-400 flight simulator program and a Boeing 767 flight deck video, together with attendant literature. Ali had all these items shipped to his employer's address. Jarrah soon decided that the schools in Germany were not acceptable and that he would have to learn to fly in the United States. Bin al-Shib also researched flight schools in Europe and in the Netherlands. He met a flight school director who recommended flight schools in the United States because they were less expensive and required shorter training periods. In March 2000, Atta emailed 31 different U.S. flight schools on behalf of a small group of men from various Arab countries studying in Germany who, while lacking prior training, were interested in learning to fly in the United States. Atta requested information about the cost of the training, potential financing, and accommodations. Before seeking visas to enter the United States, Atta, Sheehy, and Jarrah obtained new passports, each claiming that his old passport had been lost. Presumably, they were concerned that the Pakistani visas in their old passports would raise suspicions about possible travel to Afghanistan. Sheehy obtained his visa on January 18, 2000, Atta on May 18th, and Jarrah on May 25th. Bin al-Shib's visa request was rejected, however, as were his three subsequent applications. Bin al-Shib proved unable to obtain a visa, a victim of the generalized suspicion that visa applications from Yemen, especially young men applying in another country, Fennell, she first applied in Berlin, might join the ranks of undocumented aliens seeking work in the United States. Before 9/11, security concerns were not a major factor in visa issuance unless the applicant already was on a terrorist watch list, and none of these four men was. Concerns that Bin al-Shib intended to immigrate to the United States doomed his chances to participate firsthand in the 9/11 attacks. Although Bin al-Shib had to remain behind, he would provide critical assistance from abroad to his co-conspirators. Once again, the need for travel documents dictated al-Qaeda's plans. Travel. It should by now be apparent how significant travel was in the planning undertaken by a terrorist organization as far-flung as al-Qaeda. The story of the plot includes references to dozens of international trips. Operations required travel, as did basic communications and the movement of money. Where electronic communications were regarded as insecure, al-Qaeda relied even more heavily on couriers. KSM and Abu Zubaydah each played key roles in facilitating travel for Qaeda operatives. In addition, al-Qaeda had an office of passports and host country issues under its security committee. The office was located at the Kandahar airport and was managed by Atif. The committee altered papers, including passports, visas, and identification cards. Moreover, certain al-Qaeda members were charged with organizing passport collection schemes to keep the pipeline of fraudulent documents flowing. To this end, al-Qaeda required jihadists to turn in their passports before going to the front lines in Afghanistan. If they were killed, their passports were recycled for use. The Operational Mission Training Course taught operatives how to forge documents. Certain passport alteration methods, which included substituting photos and erasing and adding travel cachets, were also taught. Manuals demonstrating the technique for cleaning visas were reportedly circulated among operatives. Mohammed Atta and Zakaria Asabar were reported to have been trained in passport alteration. The purpose of all this training was twofold: to develop an institutional capacity for document forgery and to enable operatives to make necessary adjustments in the field. It was well known, for example, that if a Saudi traveled to Afghanistan via Pakistan, then on his return to Saudi Arabia, his passport bearing a Pakistani stamp would be confiscated. So, operatives either erased the Pakistani visas from their passports or traveled through Iran, which did not stamp visas directly into passports. Section 5.4. A money trail? Bin Laden and his aides did not need a very large sum to finance their planned attack on America. The 9/11 plotters eventually spent somewhere between $400,000 and $500,000 to plan and conduct their attack. Consistent with the importance of the project, al-Qaeda funded the plotters. KSM provided his operatives with nearly all the money they needed to travel to the United States, train, and live. The plotters' tradecraft was not especially sophisticated, but it was good enough. They moved, stored, and spent their money in ordinary ways, easily defeating the detection mechanisms in place at the time. The origin of the funds remains unknown, although we have a general idea of how al-Qaeda financed itself during the period leading up to 9/11. General financing. As we explained in Chapter 2, Bin Laden did not fund al-Qaeda through a personal fortune and a network of businesses in Sudan. Instead, al-Qaeda relied primarily on a fundraising network developed over time. The CIA now estimates that it cost al-Qaeda about $30 million per year to sustain its activities before 9/11, and that this money was raised almost entirely through donations. For many years, the United States thought Bin Laden financed al-Qaeda's expenses through a vast personal inheritance. Bin Laden purportedly inherited approximately $300 million when his father died, and was rumored to have had access to these funds to wage jihad while in Sudan and Afghanistan, and to secure his leadership position in al-Qaeda. In early 2000, the U.S. government discovered a different reality. Roughly, from 1970 through 1994, Bin Laden received about $1 million per year, a significant sum to be sure, but not a $300 million fortune that could be used to fund jihad. Then, as part of a Saudi government crackdown early in the 1990s, the Bin Laden family was forced to find a buyer for Osama's share of the family company in 1994. The Saudi government subsequently froze the proceeds of the sale. This action had the effect of divesting Bin Laden of what otherwise might indeed have been a larger fortune. Nor were Bin Laden's assets in Sudan a source of money for al-Qaeda. When Bin Laden lived in Sudan from 1991 to 1996, he owned a number of businesses and other assets. These could not have provided significant income, as most were small or not economically viable. When bin Laden left in 1996, it appears that the Sudanese government expropriated all his assets. He left Sudan with practically nothing. When bin Laden arrived in Afghanistan, he relied on the Taliban until he was able to reinvigorate his fundraising efforts by drawing on ties to wealthy Saudi individuals that he had established during the Afghan War in the 1980s. Al-Qaeda appears to have relied on a core group of financial facilitators who raised money from a variety of donors and other fundraisers, primarily in the Gulf countries and particularly in Saudi Arabia. Some individual donors surely knew, and others did not, the ultimate destination of their donations. Al-Qaeda and its friends took advantage of Islam's strong calls for charitable giving, zakat. These financial facilitators also appeared to rely heavily on certain imams at mosques who were willing to divert zakat donations to Al-Qaeda's cause. Al-Qaeda also collected money from employees of corrupt charities. It took two approaches to using charities for fundraising. One was to rely on Al-Qaeda sympathizers in specific foreign branch offices of large international charities, particularly those with lax external oversight and inefficient internal controls, such as the Saudi-based Al-Harman Islamic Foundation. Smaller charities in various parts of the globe were funded by these large Gulf charities and had employees who would siphon the money to Al-Qaeda. In addition, entire charities, such as the Al-Wafa organization, may have wittingly participated in funneling money to Al-Qaeda. In those cases, Al-Qaeda operatives controlled the entire organization, including access to bank accounts. Charities were a source of money and also provided significant cover, which enabled operatives to travel undetected under the guise of working for a humanitarian organization. It does not appear that any government other than the Taliban financially supported Al-Qaeda before 9/11. Although some governments may have contained Al-Qaeda sympathizers who turned a blind eye to Al-Qaeda's fundraising activities. Saudi Arabia has long been considered the primary source of Al-Qaeda funding, but we found no evidence that the Saudi government, as an institution or senior Saudi officials individually, funded the organization. This conclusion does not exclude the likelihood that charities with significant Saudi government sponsorship diverted funds to Al-Qaeda. Still, Al-Qaeda found fertile fundraising ground in Saudi Arabia, where extreme religious views are common, and charitable giving was both essential to the culture and subject to very limited oversight. Al-Qaeda also sought money from wealthy donors in other Gulf states. Al-Qaeda frequently moved the money it raised by hawala, an informal and ancient trust-based system for transferring funds. In some ways, Al-Qaeda had no choice after its move to Afghanistan in 1996. First, the banking system there was antiquated and undependable, and second, formal banking was risky due to the scrutiny that Al-Qaeda received after the August 1998 East Africa embassy bombings, including UN resolutions against it and the Taliban. Bin Laden relied on the established hawala networks operating in Pakistan, in Dubai, and throughout the Middle East to transfer funds efficiently. Hawaladers associated with Al-Qaeda may have used banks to move and store money, as did various Al-Qaeda fundraisers and operatives outside of Afghanistan. But there is little evidence that bin Laden or core Al-Qaeda members used banks while in Afghanistan. Before 9/11, Al-Qaeda spent funds as quickly as it received them. Actual terrorist operations represented a relatively small part of Al-Qaeda's estimated $30 million annual operating budget. Al-Qaeda funded salaries for jihadists, training camps, airfields, vehicles, arms, and the development of training manuals. Bin Laden provided approximately $10 to $20 million per year to the Taliban in return for safe haven. Bin Laden also may have used money to create alliances with other terrorist organizations, although it is unlikely that Al-Qaeda was funding an overall jihad program. Rather, bin Laden selectively provided startup funds to new groups or money for specific terrorist operations. Al-Qaeda has been alleged to have used a variety of illegitimate means, particularly drug trafficking and conflict diamonds, to finance itself. While the drug trade was a source of income for the Taliban, it did not serve the same purpose for Al-Qaeda, and there is no reliable evidence that bin Laden was involved in or made his money through drug trafficking. Similarly, we've seen no persuasive evidence that Al-Qaeda funded itself by trading in African conflict diamonds. There also have been claims that Al-Qaeda financed itself through manipulation of the stock market based on its advanced knowledge of the 9/11 attacks. Exhaustive investigations by the Securities and Exchange Commission, FBI, and other agencies have uncovered no evidence that anyone with advanced knowledge of the attacks profited through securities transactions. To date, the U.S. government has not been able to determine the origin of the money used for the 9/11 attacks. ultimately, the question is of little practical significance. Al-Qaeda had many avenues of funding. If a particular funding source had dried up, Al-Qaeda could have easily tapped a different source or diverted funds from another project to fund an operation that cost $400,000 to $500,000 over nearly 2 years. The funding of the 9/11 plot. As noted above, the 9/11 plotters spent somewhere between $400,000 and $500,000 to plan and conduct their attack. The available evidence indicates that the 19 operatives were funded by Al-Qaeda, either through wire transfers or cash provided by KSM, which they carried into the United States, or deposited in foreign accounts and accessed from this country. Our investigation has uncovered no credible evidence that any person in the United States gave the hijackers substantial financial assistance. Similarly, we've seen no evidence that any foreign government or foreign government official supplied any funding. We've found no evidence that the Hamburg cell members Atta, Sheehy, Jarrah, and Bin al-Shib received funds from Al-Qaeda before late 1999. It appears they supported themselves. KSM, Bin al-Shib, and another plot facilitator, Mustafa al-Hawsawi, each received money, in some cases perhaps as much as $10,000, to perform their roles in the plot. After the Hamburg recruits joined the 9/11 conspiracy, Al-Qaeda began giving them money. Our knowledge of the funding during this period, before the operatives entered the United States, remains murky. According to KSM, the Hamburg cell members each received $5,000 to pay for their own return to Germany from Afghanistan, after they'd been selected to join the plot, and they received additional funds for travel from Germany to the United States. Financial transactions of the plotters are discussed in more detail in Chapter 7. Requirements for a successful attack. As some of the core operatives prepared to leave for the United States, Al-Qaeda's leaders could have reflected on what they needed to be able to do in order to organize and conduct a complex international terrorist operation to inflict catastrophic harm. We believe such a list of requirements would have included leaders able to evaluate, approve, and supervise the planning and direction of the operation, communications efficient to enable planning and direction of the operatives and those who would be helping them, a personnel system that could recruit candidates, vet them, indoctrinate them, and give them necessary training, an intelligence effort to gather required information and form assessments of enemy strengths and weaknesses, the ability to move people, and the ability to raise and move the necessary money. The information we've presented about the development of the plane's operation shows how, by the spring and summer of 2000, Al-Qaeda was able to meet these requirements. By late May 2000, two operatives assigned to the plane's operation were already in the United States. Three of the four Hamburg cell members would soon arrive.
Chapter 6. From Threat to Threat. In Chapters 3 and 4, we described how the U.S. government adjusted its existing agencies and capacities to address the emerging threat from Osama bin Laden and his associates. After the August 1998 bombings of the American embassies in Kenya and Tanzania, President Bill Clinton and his chief aides explored ways of getting bin Laden expelled from Afghanistan, or possibly capturing or even killing him. Although disruption efforts around the world had achieved some successes, the core of bin Laden's organization remained intact. President Clinton was deeply concerned about bin Laden. He and his national security advisor, Samuel Sandy Berger, ensured they had a special daily pipeline of reports feeding them the latest updates on bin Laden's reported location. In public, President Clinton spoke repeatedly about the threat of terrorism, referring to terrorist training camps, but saying little about bin Laden and nothing about Al-Qaeda. He explained to us that this was deliberate, intended to avoid enhancing bin Laden's stature by giving him unnecessary publicity. His speeches focused especially on the danger of non-state actors and of chemical and biological weapons. As the millennium approached, the most publicized worries were not about terrorism, but about computer breakdowns, the Y2K scare. Some government officials were concerned that terrorists would take advantage of such breakdowns. Section 6.1. The Millennium Crisis. Quote, "Bodies will pile up in sacks." End quote. On November 30, 1999, Jordanian intelligence intercepted a telephone call between Abu Zubaydah, a longtime ally of bin Laden, and Qadir Abu Hoshar, a Palestinian extremist. Abu Zubaydah said, "The time for training is over." Suspecting that this was a signal for Abu Hoshar to commence a terrorist operation, Jordanian police arrested Abu Hoshar and 15 others and informed Washington. One of the 16, Rayed Hijazi, had been born in California to Palestinian parents. After spending his childhood in the Middle East, he had returned to Northern California, taken refuge in extremist Islamist beliefs, and then made his way to Abu Zubaydah's Khaldan camp in Afghanistan, where he learned the fundamentals of guerrilla warfare. He and his younger brother had been recruited by Abu Hoshar into a loosely knit plot to attack Jewish and American targets in Jordan. After late 1996, when Abu Hoshar was arrested and jailed, Hijazi moved back to the United States, worked as a cab driver in Boston, and sent money back to his fellow plotters. After Abu Hoshar's release, Hijazi shuttled between Boston and Jordan, gathering money and supplies. With Abu Hoshar, he recruited in Turkey and Syria, as well as Jordan. With Abu Zubaydah's assistance, Abu Hoshar sent these recruits to Afghanistan for training. In late 1998, Hijazi and Abu Hoshar had settled on a plan. They would first attack four targets: the SAS Radisson Hotel in downtown Amman, the border crossings from Jordan into Israel, and two Christian holy sites, at a time when all these locations were likely to be thronged with American and other tourists. Next, they would target a local airport and other religious and cultural sites. Hijazi and Abu Hoshar cased the intended targets and sent reports to Abu Zubaydah, who approved their plan. Finally, back in Amman from Boston, Hijazi gradually accumulated bomb-making materials, including sulfuric acid and 5,200 pounds of nitric acid, which were then stored in an enormous sub-basement dug by the plotters over a period of 2 months underneath a rented house. In early 1999, Hijazi and Abu Hoshar contacted Khalil Deek, an American citizen and an associate of Abu Zubaydah, who lived in Peshawar, Pakistan, and who, with Afghanistan-based extremists, had created an electronic version of a terrorist manual, the Encyclopedia of Jihad. They obtained a CD-ROM of this encyclopedia from Deek. In June, with help from Deek, Abu Hoshar arranged with Abu Zubaydah for Hijazi and three others to go to Afghanistan for added training in handling explosives. In late November 1999, Hijazi reportedly swore before Abu Zubaydah the bayat to bin Laden, committing himself to do anything bin Laden ordered. He then departed for Jordan and was at a waypoint in Syria when Abu Zubaydah sent Abu Hoshar the message that prompted Jordanian authorities to roll up the whole cell. After the arrests of Abu Hoshar and 15 others, the Jordanians tracked Deek to Peshawar, persuaded Pakistan to extradite him, and added him to their catch. Searches in Amman found the rented house and, among other things, 71 drums of acids, several forged Saudi papers, detonators, and Deek's encyclopedia. Six of the accomplices were sentenced to death. In custody, Hijazi's younger brother said that the group's motto had been, "The season is coming, and bodies will pile up in sacks." Diplomacy and disruption. On December 4th, as news came in about the discoveries in Jordan, National Security Council Counterterrorism Coordinator Richard Clark wrote Berger, "If George's," that's George Tenet's, "story about a planned series of UBL attacks at the Millennium is true, we will need to make some decisions now." He told us he held several conversations with President Clinton during the crisis. He suggested threatening reprisals against the Taliban in Afghanistan in the event of any attacks on U.S. interests anywhere by bin Laden. He further proposed to Berger that a strike be made during the last week of 1999 against Al-Qaeda camps in Afghanistan, a proposal not adopted. Warned by the CIA that the disrupted Jordanian plot was probably part of a larger series of attacks intended for the Millennium, some possibly involving chemical weapons, the Principals Committee met on the night of December 8th and decided to task Clark's Counterterrorism Security Group, or CSG, to develop plans to deter and disrupt Al-Qaeda plots. Michael Sheehan, the State Department member of the CSG, communicated warnings to the Taliban that they would be held responsible for future Al-Qaeda attacks. Mike was not diplomatic, Clark reported to Berger. With virtually no evidence of a Taliban response, a new approach was made to Pakistan. General Anthony Zinni, the commander of Central Command, CENTCOM, was designated as the President's special envoy and sent to ask General Musharraf to take whatever action you deem necessary to resolve the bin Laden problem at the earliest possible time. But Zinni came back empty-handed. As Ambassador William Milam reported from Islamabad, Musharraf was unwilling to take the political heat at home. The CIA worked hard with foreign security services to detain or at least keep an eye on suspected bin Laden associates. Tenet spoke to 20 of his foreign counterparts. Disruption and arrest operations were mounted against terrorists in 8 countries. In mid-December, President Clinton signed a Memorandum of Notification, MON, giving the CIA broader authority to use foreign proxies to detain bin Laden lieutenants without having to transfer them to U.S. custody. The authority was to capture, not kill, though lethal force might be used if necessary. Tenet would later send a message to all CIA personnel overseas saying, "The threat could not be more real.